Oh, okay, sure. What is it?
It's just a recorder. I have
okay. Oh, okay, yeah, that's fine. Sure. So, okay, let's go ahead and get started. So, so we started out, in the past two classes, we started out going over this classification method called logistic regression. And then we went on this detour to learn about numerical optimization, because it turned out that we would need to know about these, about gradients and optimization procedures in order to do learning in the logistic regression model. So today, let's go back and let's see how, now that we know all of this about how to do gradient descent for general functions, how we can apply this to do learning in the linear regression model. So by way of review, what we said last week was that logistic regression is a particular type of linear classification method. So in some ways, it's an analog of linear regression to the classification problem. Now, I mean, linear classification seems a little bit like a contradiction in terms. Right? Because in linear regression, we figured, oh, okay, there was this underlying linear function. We had this continuous target, and we were assuming that the target is linear as a function of the inputs. Okay, well, that's something that at least makes sense. If we have, maybe the function really is linear. Maybe it's close to linear. But for classification, we know that the function can't be linear, right? Because our target is 0, 1. So if you think in terms of the So if you think in terms of weight space, there's just some area of weight space where it's class 0 and the target is just always 0, and then there's a big step at the decision boundary, and then the target's always 1. So the whole idea of linear classification almost seems like a contradiction in terms. It's not, right? So the way we do that, we want to get a linear problem because, you know, we get all these computational benefits by doing so. And so in order to get a linear problem, what we do is we convert the class labeling. Instead of thinking of the class labeling being 0, 1, we think of this linear function, which is this f of xw. And f of xw is basically the degree to which, in a binary classification setting, it's the degree to which the instance is positive. So now this thing is going to be a real number, and we expect f of xw to be really big for things that are very much in the positive class, and we expect it to be very negative for things that are in the negative class. And then when f of xw is 0, that's the decision boundary. So now this lets us convert the classification problem, this kind of crazy nonlinear problem, into a problem that has a nice continuous form. So for example, this linear function that's at the top of the slide. And now we can do things that are more like this kind of continuous optimization regression that are easier to deal with computationally. So what we did in logistic regression is we said, okay, let's have this function f of xw, let's have it be linear, and we're going to convert this into the probability that the class label y is 1. And the way that we're going to do this is we're going to define the squashing function that takes wtx plus w0, this predictor that we have, and it maps it to 0, 1. And then by doing that, we can interpret that number between 0 and 1 has the probability that y equals 1. And the particular squashing function that we used was called the sigmoid function. And so that was the first example that we've seen of a linear classifier, was this logistic regression classifier. And we'll see a couple of other linear classifiers in this course before we're done. And unlike linear regression, not all of them will be probabilistic. So now let's take a geometric perspective on what linear classification looks like. So this is a picture that we also saw last week. So here we have... the axes that aren't drawn are in feature space. So each one of these points represents a training example, and the x-axis is feature 1, and the y-axis is feature 2. So we're assuming there's only two features, so I can fit it on the slide. And what we saw is that if you look at the function, if I look at wtx equals 0, That defines a line in feature space. And that line is the decision boundary. It's a line at which the classifier is exactly unsure whether to make it class 0 or class 1. And so if I can say, well, where is WTX greater than 0? And that's going to be a half plane. That's going to be all the points that for which this f of xw are positive is going to be on one side of this line, and all the lines where it's negative are going to be on the other side of this line. And it turns out that the weight vector itself, w, is actually going to be perpendicular to the decision boundary. That's just a fact of linear functions, that whenever I have two vectors whose dot product are 0, they're perpendicular. So this line here, is the decision boundary, is just the set of all vectors that are perpendicular to w. That's just a geometric way of expressing the equation that was on the previous slide. So what I'm looking for in a linear classification problem is some weight vector such that when I draw this decision boundary here, I've separated the data. So all the instances in class 0 are on one side, and all the instances on class 1 are on the other side. So that's the goal in linear classification. Okay, so now let's talk about logistic regression more specifically. So we had this function which was WTX plus W0. This thing W0 is a kind of a bias. You know, it doesn't depend on any of the features, but it's sort of the base rate. It's analogous to the prior class probability in naive Bayes. In a very, very exact sense, it's analogous to this. So basically, this affects, in a probabilistic sense, this kind of affects the base rate, or it has to do with the base rate of how often do I expect to see positive examples versus negative examples. So in general, it will happen that if I have a data set in which positive examples are more likely, then the bias parameter that I learn will tend to be larger. Now, geometrically speaking, if the bias parameter shifts the position of the hyperplane, it shifts essentially, if I go back here, it'll change the y-intercept of that line, but it doesn't change the angle of it, right? So what that means, the angle of the hyperplane only depends on the weights that actually correspond to the real features. So before, we've been calling that weight vector W tilde. So what we have here is the hyperplane is perpendicular to W tilde. Now, the magnitude of the vector also has an interpretation. Basically, it has to do with how certain the classifications are. So the way you can think about this is that, remember I said this f of xw, if I multiply w by a really big constant, what that's going to do is that's going to make f of xw a lot bigger. It's going to make the magnitude of this f of xw a lot bigger for all of the examples. And so if you remember from, we saw this graph of the sigmoid function before, it was monotonic. So the bigger f is, the bigger the probability is. So if I multiply w by a constant that's greater than 1, then what's going to happen is all of my probabilities are going to get closer to 0. They're going to become more certain. They're going to either be closer to 0 or they're going to be closer to 1. And conversely, if I make the norm of w smaller, so what I mean by that is say I multiplied all the weights in the vector w by a half or by a third, then what's going to happen is all of the f's are going to get closer to 0. They're going to become less positive if they're positive, or they're going to become less negative if they're negative. And so what's going to happen is all of the probabilities are going to get closer to 0.5, because we saw before that the sigmoid function at 0 happens to be 0.5, or it's designed to be 0.5. So that's basically what the norm of the weight vector is telling you. And then we've already said the last two things that, so that's the last two bullets there. Okay, so let's think more about what any linear classifier can do or can't do, irrespective of how we get the weights of linear classifier, how we get the weights. So we said before, if we can classify the training data perfectly, you know, what that means is that we found some set of weights, W0 and W tilde, you know, such that all the positive examples were on one side, so they were greater than 0, and all the negative examples were on the other side, but they were less than 0. So it makes sense that if I have a set of examples that's really jumbled up, that maybe I can't find a weight vector that separates the data perfectly. So it turns out there's a very simple example of an example where I can't actually separate the weight vector perfectly. And that's this example of basically an exclusive OR function up here. So what this is the black dots are positive examples. The white dots are negative examples. And the black dots both appear at 0. So basically, you want to learn a function that says if my inputs are opposite each other, if they're 0, 1, or 1, 0, I want to be a positive example. Otherwise, I want to be a negative example. So it turns out, so say I wanted to train a linear classifier on this data set. So I want to find some line such that all the positive examples are on one side and all the negative examples are on the other side. Well, it's pretty clear that I can't do that, right? Because any line that puts these two black guys on one side is going to hit one of the filled circles. So there's no linear classifier whatsoever that can solve this problem, no matter what kind of learning algorithm that I use. And historically, this was a really important example because back in the 50s, there was this algorithm called the perceptron algorithm for learning linear classifiers, and we'll talk about that when we talk about neural networks. But people got really excited about these kind of linear classification algorithms, and they thought, okay, this is going to be the solution to how we understand the brain, that we just have, like, you know, 10 to the 14th little linear classifiers sitting in there, all connected to each other in a network. And then somebody pointed out, well, linear classifiers can't even do this. So if they can't even do this problem, then how the heck do you expect them to do face recognition? So people got really, really depressed about it, depressed about linear classifiers. And you know, this had a real impact for a long time on the way the research community went in artificial intelligence. So now it turns out that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be that depressed about linear classifiers on this problem, because if we change the feature set, you know, then we'd be able to do this quite. If the feature set is x0, x1, we can't do anything. But just like for linear regression, we saw, well, if we change the feature set, if we add some derived features, then we can represent a much richer set of classification functions. And it turns out, I'm actually not going to tell you the answer to this question on this slide, but it turns out if you think about it for probably about 3 or 4 seconds, you could come up with another feature that you could add to this, which would make these points easily linearly separable. Okay, so those remarks held for any linear classifier that you want. Anything that uses that linear rule to classify instances. So now we're going to talk about how logistic regression picks the parameters W. So now, you know, as before, we have some training data for doing classification, and we want to come up with the best parameters in some sense. So we're going to, in a broad sense, we're going to use the same kind of methodology that we did for linear regression. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, well, we have a probabilistic model of the training data. You know, we have some probability distribution over the class labels given the input. So now we can write down a likelihood. So we'll write down a likelihood of the training data, and that's going to be a function of W. So for some values W, the class labels that I saw in the training data are going to be more likely, and for some other values they're going to be less likely. Then I'm going to try to find the optimum value of the likelihood with respect to W. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the derivatives of the log likelihood, and then I'm going to use the derivatives to do optimization. So I'm going to try to numerically maximize the log likelihood. Okay, so let's go through this in a little bit more detail. We're going to assume, as usual in the course, that the data is independent and identically distributed. So what that means is that the likelihood looks something like this on the top slide, that it's a product over all the training examples. So we're assuming that there are n training examples. We're going to number them from I through 1 to n. And the product of the joint probability of the entire training set, condition of the parameters, we're going to say that's just the product over each training example of the probability of the class label I, given xi, the input for I, the input for training instance I, and the parameters w. Okay, so we can rewrite this as in the, so the second line is kind of a notational trick for rewriting this thing. So this thing yi is going to be either 0 or 1, depending on whether the training instance was positive or negative. So there's some algebraic trick that we can use that helps us write out the derivatives. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, well, we know that yi equals 0 or 1. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the probability that, I'm sorry, that should say yi on the second line. So I'm going to take the probability that yi equals 1, and I want that to count only if the training instance was positive. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to raise it to the power yi. So now if yi is 1, then this term gets to count. If yi is 0, anything to the 0th power is 1. So this term will drop away, and the probability won't factor into the likelihood. Whereas on the other hand, if yi is 0, then the second term is the one that's going to get the vote. And that's 1 minus the probability y equals 1, also known as the probability that y equals 0. And that's raised to the 1 minus yi power. So that's only going to count for the negative examples, where yi equals 1. So this is just kind of a notational trick for writing an if-then statement in algebra. So that's another way of writing the likelihood. And then we're going to optimize the logarithm of the likelihood rather than the actual probability. And that's just for mathematical convenience, because the log is going to turn this product into a sum. And that's just a little bit easier to work with. So once we take the log of the likelihood, we're just going to get the sum over all training instances. And you'll see this exponentiation trick now turns into multiplication when we do the log. So we'll say if the training instance is positive, then I'll have the log, and this sigmoid thing is just what we wrote out from the previous lecture of how we wrote out the probability that y equals 1. So this is just the sigmoid function of that sigmoid transformation of that linear thing we've already seen. You know, plus if the training instance, so that's if the training instance is positive, and if it's negative, then I get the log probability that the class label is 0. So that's it. So that's the likelihood function, and that's this thing that we're going to try to maximize with respect to w. And in fact, last time I actually was telling you about minimization algorithms. I was telling you how to get to the bottom of a bowl. I didn't tell you how to get to the top of anything. But it turns out that's no problem, because we can just define this function e, which is negative l. And so anytime I want to minimize a function, that's the same as maximizing its negative, right? So we can just minimize this function minus l with respect to the parameters, and it's the same thing as maximizing. So what we're going to do now is we're going to try to minimize this function e. So in the linear regression slide, we had this function e that we wanted to minimize, and it was squared error. And we were lucky in that we were able to do that analytically. We were just able to say, you know, do some matrix operations and take the inverse of some big matrix, and then that gave us exactly the minimum. For logistic regression, we're not that lucky. So the likelihood isn't as computationally nice as the squared error. So rather than just being able to write down the minimum using calculus, we actually have to go and use the numerical methods that we talked about in the previous lecture. So basically that's what you do. So in order to use those methods that we talked about, we said, well, we have to have the gradient of the likelihood. So you can take the partial derivatives of the gradient just as using calculus. And it turns out that the thing that you get is again a sum over all training instances, which makes sense because, you know, derivatives are additive. And the thing that's inside, I'm not going to derive this gradient, although it's not actually that hard to do if you remember calculus. But it has this nice interpretation. So this thing f of xi is just like f of xi comma w that we had on the previous slide, that we had earlier. And we're just saying, well, what's the difference between this thing and the true training label? So if I got the training instance correct, that thing is going to be nearly 0. And it's going to be that times, so this is the partial derivative of some feature, of some weight wj. And that weight corresponds to some feature. It's being multiplied by some feature xij in all of the training examples. So it's going to be, so the gradient is the sum over all the training examples of this thing, which is, you know, the degree to which I got the class label wrong in the current parameter vector, times the feature that's corresponding to that weight in that instance. And I take the sum over that over all the training examples, and that's the gradient. So it turns out, as a nice little notational thing, that this same kind of general notation for the gradient also holds for linear regression, right? So we saw that I can use different optimization methods for the same likelihood. And if I had some reason that I didn't want to do the analytic optimization for linear regression, I could just as well do gradient descent. And the gradient would have this very similar form. So one thing that I want to do is I want to go through this the gradient of the, there's actually a nice geometric interpretation of this gradient for logistic regression, and I kind of want to go through that so you see kind of what's happening if I were to run a gradient descent optimizer for logistic regression. Okay, so here's the gradient up here again. So let's think about the gradient for just one training example. So let's forget the fact that I have this sum from I equals 1 to n at the top here. So let's assume there's only one example in the training set. So now I'm going to do these iterative optimization procedures, just like I was talking about last time. So I'm going to have some current weight vector, and now I'm going to compute the gradient. So there are basically three different cases. So one case is at the current parameter vector, I've already gotten xi right. So what that means is if I take this, that, so let's just say that I is a positive instance. right? So then what's gonna happen is that, well, if the classifier of the current weight vector got xi right, then what that means is this f of xi, which is just the sigmoid transformation, which is just the probability that the model's probability that y equals 1 given xi, we'll just say that is going to be something that's very close to 1. So that's one thing that could happen. Another possibility is that I'm far away from a good parameter setting, so I've actually got the class label wrong for xi. So that means, you know, my probability that xi is 1 is something, might be something like 0.2, or might be something even worse. Finally, another kind of possibility is maybe that I currently do have instance I right, but I'm not really confident about classification. So maybe I do have the probability of y equals 1 is greater than 0.5, but I'm not really sure about it. I'm only a little bit above 0.5. So what I want to do is I take one step in the direction of this gradient, what I want to talk about is what happens to the parameter setting in each of these three cases. Because remember, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this gradient up at the top, and I'm going to go a small step eta in the direction of the gradient. So if I use this current weight vector w, if that's the one I use to compute the gradient, then my next one, w prime, is just going to be w minus eta times the gradient. So what's going to happen? So the first thing, in the first case, suppose I got the training instance right, and I was really sure that I had it right. Then what that means is, so yi is 1, because this is a positive training instance. So f of xi minus yi, that's going to be almost 0, because I nearly got it right. So what that means is if I take a step in the direction of the gradient, I'm not going to change the parameters. So that's nice. That means that doing gradient descent, so if I have all the training instances right, then doing gradient descent doesn't change the parameters. That seems like, you know, that's what you want. Okay, that's good. So now let's say, well, f of xi is wrong. So say I have some training instance where I haven't figured out how to classify it yet. Okay, so the first thing is, something we had is that f of xi minus yi, that's always negative, right? Because yi is going to be 1, and f of xi, that's coming through this sigmoid, so it's going to be between 0 and 1. Okay, so this thing is going to be negative, and xij is going to be, so the gradient is going to have the opposite sign to xij. Right, xij, it's just a feature value. It might be positive, it might be negative. But this thing in front of it is going to be some negative number. So what's going to happen is the new parameter setting that I get, I'm subtracting again, so there's another minus sign. So it's going to move in the direction of xij. So what that means is if xij is positive, then wj is going to get more positive. If xij is negative, then wj is going to get more negative. So whatever that means, it means that f of xi is going to get bigger in the next iteration, right? Because I'm taking this linear weight w, and I'm making it bigger. So that means that f of xi is going to go up in the next iteration. Okay, so that's also what you want, right? Because if I want f of xi to be 1, and it's really something a lot less than 1, then I want it to go up. You know, that seems good. Now, the interesting thing is that's also going to happen if f of xi isn't correct enough. So if f of xi is 0.6, I'm still getting the right answer, but I'm not exactly hitting 1 yet. So logistic regression is going to do is it's really going to try to make f of xi be something 1. So if I think back to this sigmoid curve that was on the beginning of the slide that looked, it's probably not worth drawing it, but I'm really going to try to move things off to the right on the sigmoid curve so that I really want all of my f of xi's. So logistic regression is going to be happy when all of these f of xi's are either 1 or either 1 or 0. It's not going to be happy. It's not going to leave things at 0.6 if it can at all avoid that. So that's kind of the geometric intuition about what logistic regression is doing for a single training example. And you'll see, notice I have this sum over all training. But really, I do have more than one training instance. I do have a sum over all training instances. So it's going to try to find a weight vector that balances all of these things in such a way that if it can, it'll make all of these f of xi's be kind of extreme and to match the training data. So let's step back. So we saw that, just to summarize, logistic regression is a discriminative method for classification, right? So rather than defining a joint distribution over y and x, it means it's only interested in modeling the conditional probability of y given x. And we saw, well, that could make sense if I have some complex feature space, that I don't want to model the probabilistic dependencies among the features. And then it decides on a particular model structure, which is essentially a linear model with a squashing function on top of it. Now, given that model structure, I could define lots of ways to define the best parameters. I could define lots of score functions that would say, pick me the W. But what I do in logistic regression is I maximize the log likelihood. Now, the final thing that I have to specify for any learning algorithm is how am I going to find the maximum value of the log likelihood in the logistic regression model. And here we actually have a lot of freedom. So you could implement the gradient descent rule that we talked about in the previous lecture. It implemented on that likelihood from the slide. And that would be a valid implementation of the logistic regression classifier. But it's usually not the most efficient one. So it turns out that if you actually go to Weka and ask it to run logistic regression, it's not running gradient descent. You know, usually it's running one of these kind of fancier methods that we kind of mentioned that also takes gradients into account. But that's a detail that you don't really need to worry about when you're thinking about logistic regression, because you don't necessarily care about how it found the maximum likelihood parameters as long as it found them. It's just some methods might take more time or less time. But as a user of the method, you know, you don't really care. Okay, so here's an example of applying logistic regression to a real data set. So one of the types of applications for which logistic regression has been very successful has been text categorization. So this thing, SpamBase, is actually a fairly small data set for classifying emails about whether they're spam or not. So this has about 4,000 instances and, you know, roughly 50 attributes that are basically the frequencies of various word tokens in the email. So each training instance is going to be an email. This isn't necessarily the best feature set for doing spam filtering, in the sense that, I mean, it's nice to have the word features when you're doing spam filtering, but it's also really important to have features of the sender and features of, you know, the certain IP blocks. So, like, you know, real spam classifiers also consider, like, what IP block did the message come from. But I don't think that's one of the features in this data set. So anyway, you could train a logistic regression model in Weka, and you can look at what the coefficients of the different attributes are. So the coefficients that have negative weights are going to be associated very much with the class label 0, which is not spam. So you see things like, well, these are from emails at HP Labs. So when you see people writing things about HP, well, typically those aren't spam. You see people write things about computer science, those also don't tend to be spam. And you see those things have extremely high weight. Whereas if you look at words that are indicative of spam, so things that have to do with, you know, sending money to Nigeria, I guess, then those things tend to have higher weight, tend to be more indicative of spam. Okay, so we talked before about this is linear regression, but one thing that's kind of important to emphasize is that, you know, you can always expand any of these linear methods by having a more interesting feature set. So one kind of feature set that is that's kind of very interesting is this idea of doing a Gaussian basis function. So this is especially important with support vector machines, which we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes. So here's an example of a binary classification problem, which isn't linearly separable in the original feature space. But if I add one of these Gaussian basis functions, then it becomes very much linearly separable. So the original data set is over here on the left-hand side. And so you can see it's pretty clear that there's no way to draw a single straight line in the X1, X2 space in such a way that it actually separates all of the training instances. So here's another kind of feature set that you can use, which is useful for a lot of linear classifiers. You can say, take this green point at the center of the screen. Now, I'm going to use that green point as the mean of a Gaussian distribution. So here's what my feature value is going to be. It's going to be for any data point, so for like that this blue point over on the corner, I'm going to look at that. I'm going to take a Gaussian function with the mean at that blue cross, and whose standard deviation is given by that circle. And I'm going to say, well, what's the density? What's the density value of the Gaussian distribution at that blue data point? And that's going to be my additional feature. So basically, the feature is essentially, what's the distance of the training point from that blue cross, right? That's essentially what the feature is. So what I have on the right-hand side is now two feature functions, but one is a Gaussian function based on the cross in the middle, and one is a Gaussian feature based on that other cross there. So I have two different features. So now I have a different basis for the data.
And so you can see, like, there's some, like, near zero. So this thing on the x-axis, so phi 1 must be this one down here. And you can tell that because all these blue points are near zero. And then, you know, and then phi 2 is the other thing.
And so now in this new set, it's easy to find a linear classifier because the red examples are all near the one cross and not the other. So this gives you some sense of essentially geometrically what you're doing when you decide to add kind of nonlinear basis functions and still do a linear classifier. So the nice thing is that if you want to actually learn the basis functions, it turns out that's much more complicated computationally. And we'll talk about a way of doing that next week, but it's a lot harder than just running linear regression. So if you can do a trick like this and make it work, then it's a very good idea to do so. Okay, so one thing, we started out by saying that logistic regression was a way of applying linear regression to classification problems. But, you know, it seems like, gosh, there's a much easier way of applying linear regression to classification problems, and that's just using linear regression. So what do I mean by that? I mean, take your linear regression solver, and you know, it doesn't need to know that all of the targets can be any real number, so it doesn't need to know. Maybe just give it to linear regression, but just have all the targets be either 0 or 1. And you can use linear regression just fine, and it'll give you a weight vector. So why not do that instead? So the problem is that it turns out that, you know, sometimes you can use that as a hack, but it's not really such a good idea. And the reason is that even if I have something, so say if I ran, so if I took the example data set on the left-hand side, and I ran linear regression and I ran logistic regression, you know, they both work fairly well. So logistic regression is the green line here, and linear regression is the purple line there. And basically, you get the same answer. So it seems like all of this mathematical complication about having the sigmoid function and whatever, yeah, that seemed like a waste of time. I could have just run linear regression. But the problem is, suppose I add some points that are all the way off in the corner here. Now, those should be easy points to classify because they're really far away. So if I add these points on the right-hand side here, you know, they should be really easy to classify because they're very far away from any of the negative examples. You know, so I shouldn't have any problem at all saying that these guys are blue examples rather than red examples. But the problem is that linear regression wants those blue examples to be mapped to 1, right? It doesn't want them to be mapped to 5. It doesn't want them to be mapped to 10. It wants them to be mapped to 1, because that's what you told in the training data. So if I take this line, if I use this green line over on the left and evaluate it using the squared error rule, it's going to have very high error on these guys over on the right-hand side, because their target is 1, and the predicted value according to the green line is going to be something really huge. So these are essentially outliers from the perspective of linear regression. Even though they should be from the perspective of classification, these guys should be easy, and you shouldn't spend any time worrying about them. So the effect of having these here is that's going to bend the line from linear regression. So this purple thing is the linear regression solution, and what it's doing is it's got it tilted off downward. And the reason it's doing that is it's trying to make the prediction over those outliers be closer to 1, be something smaller than they would have been otherwise. Whereas logistic regression, on the other hand, whereas those points over there don't have much of an effect on the decision boundary for logistic regression. And the reason for that is the green line. If I take that green line and then squash it through a sigmoid, then I basically get 1. So from the perspective of linear regression, those outliers on the right-hand side introduce almost no additional error. Because even if I only trained the left-hand side, they'd already be classified as close to 1. So that's kind of a way of thinking about, you know, why it's not such a great idea to just immediately apply the least squares rule to classification. The key idea is, in classification, I don't care if I'm overly confident about the right training label. Whereas in least squares, you really want to hit the number 1 exactly. Okay, so one more thing I wanted to say before finishing up on logistic regression is to talk up a little bit more, now that we've seen what logistic regression is, about this relationship between generative models and discriminative models. So I introduced logistic regression as being a linear classifier and as being the first linear classifier that we've seen in the class, but that's actually not quite true. Okay. So let's say that, let's think about the naive Bayes model a little bit more. So let's say that I have a naive Bayes model in two classes with with continuous features, and so I'm going to have Gaussian distributions over the features, and let's assume that that the covariances. So remember in a naive Bayes classifier, the thing that I have to define is a probability distribution over the inputs, given the class label. And so for class one, I have to have one distribution of the inputs. And for class two, I have another distribution of the inputs. So the inputs are going to be, in this example, the inputs are going to be continuous. So let's define Gaussian distributions over both of the inputs. And furthermore, let's assume that, in this model, let's assume that for both classes, I'm going to have the same covariance of the Gaussian. So the spreads of the Gaussian are going to be the same for both classes. All right, so now let's look at the decision boundary for naive Bayes under this assumption. So in order to do that, let's look at the probability that class 1 equals x. So it turns out that if you do some algebra, you can look at the probability that class 1 equals x under this thing. And it's actually a linear function of the input. So if you go through this and you actually use Bayes' rule, then you actually see for some values that there is a set of weight vectors such that you can describe the decision boundary of linear regression. So what I mean is the decision boundary is the case where in linear regression, where the probability of class 1 equals x, where that probability equals 0.5. And I can say, well, what does that set look like? And it turns out you can do some algebra and you say that's actually a linear set. And so it turns out you can just prove that using algebra. So it turns out that linear regression if you have Gaussian output distributions, is also a linear classifier. It's just a linear classifier in which I choose the weights in a different way. You know, I choose the weights generatively, rather. I'm maximizing a different likelihood, right? I'm maximizing the joint probability of x and y, rather than the conditional probability of y given x. And do I have anything else about this? No. Okay, so it turns out in practice, people have looked at the differences between naive Bayes and logistic regression, because they're basically the same model. So if you think back to this kind of four-point classification of classification procedures, then naive Bayes and logistic regression are actually the same model, but they're different score functions for picking the best weights. So people have looked at kind of the differences between naive Bayes and logistic regression, and basically what people have found is that if you have enough data, logistic regression tends to perform better. But for small amounts of data, naive Bayes can perform better. So you can't say uniformly which one is better. It depends on the amount of training data. Okay, so up until now, we've always talked about logistic regression as being for two-class problems. But that's kind of limiting. You might have some class where you have a multi-class problem. So for example, I think there's there are lots of examples where I might have 5 classes or 10 classes rather than 2. So it turns out that's actually not difficult to deal with under logistic regression. So what you do is, instead of having one weight vector for the whole model, you have one weight vector for each class. So if I have k is representing the class label, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to have one weight vector wk, and I'll say for each class, I'll take that weight vector and I'll take the dot product of that weight vector with the inputs. So that basically gives me a score for each class that could be positive or negative, and so now I want to scale that score to be a positive probability. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to call that score AK. So AK is just WKT, WK transpose, transpose phi. So then what I'm going to do, so first I need to take this thing, which is just some real number, and I need to make it positive, because probabilities are always positive. And so a common trick that I can do is I can take e to that AK. So now the exponential function is always positive. So now what I've done is I've taken this number could be positive or negative, and I've mapped it to 0 infinity. Okay, well that's good, but it's still not a probability. So now what I'll do is I'll take all of these e to the aks, and I'll divide by their sum. So if I'm interested in the probability for of class ck given x, I'll take its particular weight, e to the ak, and I'll divide by the sum over all the possible classes of e to the aj for those other classes. And by doing that, I'm now guaranteed to have a number between 0 and 1, because obviously e to the ak is going to be less than the sum. So this thing is called the softmax function, because it turns out if the weights, this is a way of approximating the max function in a way that if the weights became really extreme, so if I multiply wk by a very large constant, this would start to look like a max. The other thing that's the other thing that's you need to understand about this is that this is a generalization of the sigmoid function that we saw last time. So suppose there were only two classes. So now I just have a W1 and a W2, and I force W2 to be zero. Then if I plugged those W's into there, I would just get the sigmoid function, right? Because I would just get e to the zero over e to the WTX plus e to the zero. So which is just 1 over 1 plus e to the WTX. So this is just a generalization of the two-class sigmoid function to multiple classes. So that's kind of a nice thing about logistic regression, is that it's easy to generalize to multi-class classification. Okay, so that's actually all that I have to say about logistic regression. So basically, you know, like we saw that it was a way of extending linear classification to multiple dimensions. We saw there was this important concept called linear separability that was about what decision boundaries any linear classifier could represent. And you know, we saw that to actually compute the best weights according to linear regression, that we had to use gradient descent or in practice some more complicated optimization procedure. So I'm gonna go on after this to a different classification technique. So if there are any questions about logistic regression or about linear classification more generally, this would be a good time for them. Okay, so I'll go on to support vector machines. Okay, if I have the slides here. Okay, good. Oh, wait. Oh yeah, that's right, these are the right slides, okay. Good. Okay. So support vector machines are kind of relatively recent as classification algorithms go. I think they're no more than 10 or 15 years old. I forget when the first, actually forget the year of the first SVM paper now. But they're actually now, they're one of the most effective and widely used classification algorithms. And basically, and they're a linear classifier, just like logistic regression, but they choose the classification boundary in a different way. And so SVMs are the combination of two different ideas. It's basically maximum margin classification with the kernel trick. So I'm going to talk about, so the rest of the lecture is going to talk about, you know, what both of these things are. So to understand what maximum margin classification is, we're going to start to get into some, we're going to get into a bit of kind of vector algebra. So you need to remember some things from, you know, back from geometry. So the first thing that you need to remember is what the dot product actually means. So, you know, up until now, we've kind of been using it as a shorthand for representing linear functions, but it also has a geometric interpretation. It has several geometric interpretations, which are very important. So up here, let's say that the beautiful drawing up here, let's say that W is a unit vector, so that's going to be some vector, and then I have a dashed line, which is just, well, if I continued the vector W out to infinity, and X is just going to be some arbitrary vector. So there's a geometric interpretation of the dot product of W onto X, and what it is it's the length of the projection of X onto W. So what that means is if I take this vector X and I draw it down a perpendicular so that it hits the ray defined by W, then the dot product of W and X is just the length of from zero to where I actually hit on that projection. And that's the case if W is a unit vector. Okay, so now let's go back to, let's apply kind of this idea to linear classification. So in linear classification, we're looking for this kind of separating hyperplane, which is defined by W tilde. So intuitively, just looking at this, this looks like a bad example of a separating hyperplane, right? If I gave you this training data and I said, you know, draw a line through it, that's not the line you'd pick, right? Because, you know, it's really, you know, why should it be so much closer to the zeros over here than to the x's over here? You know, it makes more sense that if I just showed you that data and said draw a line through it, that you'd draw something kind of halfway between. Because you think, well, you know, near that zero, there's probably other zeros near there. So I don't want to make the line too close. And that's the idea behind a maximum margin classifier. So basically what it does is it says, let's take the hyperplane that separates the two classes, and let's look at the distance, the perpendicular distance, between the nearest negative example and the nearest positive example. And let's take the example on either side that's closest to the hyperplane. So d plus is going to be on the slide is the distance to the closest positive one, and d minus is the closest negative one. Now the other thing that's kind of a little bit of notation on this slide is you notice in the previous set of slides, my class labels were 0 and 1. Were 0 and 1. So the negative examples were all mapped to y equals 0. In this example, and this one I've changed it, I've said, well, the negative examples for this lecture are going to be negative 1 rather than 0. It turns out that's not a mistake, and that's not arbitrary. It turns out that makes the notation going forward a lot easier. So right now we're plus 1 and minus 1, not 1 and 0. So the margin is going to be, well, whichever one of these guys is closest is going to be that distance. So that's what we're going to call the margin. And the idea behind the support vector machine is going to choose the linear weights as before, but I'm going to choose them in such a way that it has a maximum margin. So it turns out I'll show you a picture in a second. It turns out if you think about this, that once I found the maximum margin solution, I'm going to be equally far from the positive examples than the negative examples. Because if I were closer to zero, like on this slide, you can see, well, I'm too close to the negative instances. So if I move my decision boundary a little bit closer to x's, the margin would get bigger. And then it would happen that the distance to each of these example sets would be closer to being equal. So here's kind of geometrically what a maximum margin classifier looks like. So this thing here is the decision boundary, the slanted line in the middle. So this thing w tilde is the weight vector of the classifier. So here you see I've drawn that vector starting it at 0. And just as before, you see that if I were to extend it out, that it would be perpendicular to the, it would be normal to the decision boundary, right? And that has to be the case. And now if I imagine looking at, so imagine I take this plane, which is normal to W, and I start at the decision boundary.
So this is the, and then I kind of sweep it down.
Until I hit the first negative training example.
So the distance that I had to sweep it in both directions,
you know, that's the margin. Okay, so how can we write this? So that's geometrically what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the margin. But what does that mean algebraically? So I need some equation that I can write down what the margin is. Okay, so this is how you get that. I think it's actually going to be a little bit clearer. So I put that on the slide so you'd have it to look at later. But I think it's actually going to be a little bit clearer if you see where this comes from, kind of one step at a time. Okay, good. No. Stop. No. I should bring my own chalk. That would be smarter. That's okay. Or I should bring my iPad. That's what I should have done. Okay. Well, that's. Oh, there's. I don't know if I want to try using that. That seems a little bit dangerous. Here we go. Okay. So what we're gonna do? Okay. So let's start with the axes here. So basically, I'm just going to reproduce this diagram up on the board. So you don't have to write this down because it's right up there. So I'm going to start. So here is the weight vector for a linear classifier. So I'm going to just talk about, okay, so what does the margin mean? So we said, well, so the idea is we're going to write the margin in terms of dot products. And so in order to do that, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, so this vector W could have some kind of arbitrary norm. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to rescale this vector W so that it has norm 1. So I'm going to call E, that's this thing right here, and that's just a scale version of W. So I'll say E is just the vector W, so this should be W tilde. It's just W tilde over the norm of W tilde. So this is just a unit vector. So now let's say I have some example here, and that's in the negative class. And so the decision boundary is here. So this thing is the decision boundary. It's just the line of W tilde T x plus W0 equals 0. So that just defines a line. So that's this thing here. And now let's say I have some other example here, which is going to be my positive example. So the thing that I want in order to compute the margin is just the distance from here to here plus the distance from here to here. Now the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to project them both down in order to get this distance easily. I'm going to project them both down to this ray here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this x and project it down here. That's going to give me one point here. Then I'm going to take x plus and I'm going to project it down here. That gives me another point. And I'll just take the difference between this guy and this guy and that'll be the margin. Okay, so the first question is, well, what is this vector here? Well, the length of this vector, since E is just a unit vector, we know what the length of this thing is here. The length of this thing here is just x minus transpose E, right? Because that's just what we said geometrically, that's what a dot product means. This length here is just x plus transpose E, because that's what a dot product is. So if I want the distance of these lengths, the distance of these two lengths is just E. So I'll say the margin, which is D plus plus D minus, is just E transpose X plus minus E.